Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Gutierrez of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel, and today we are pleased to have with us Professor Patrick Kurz. Professor Kurz is Professor of International History at the University of Florence. He has previously taught at Yale and has been a fellow of both Harvard University and St. Anthony's College, Oxford. Today we are discussing his newest book, The New Atlantic Order, The Transformation of International Politics, 1860 to 1933, published by Cambridge University Press. Welcome, Professor.
Yes, thank you so much, and thank you for having me on the New Books Network. I'm pleased to be here.
Professor, what is the thesis of your book?
Well, there's more than one thesis, but one of the main ones is that we have to understand in a new way both the origins of the First World War and especially the transformation of the global order that ensued in the aftermath of this great war. And I'm trying to show that the real first attempt to build a modern world order, namely that undertaken at the Paris Peace Conference, was at the core really a bid to build a new Atlantic order undertaken between European and American protagonists, which then had massive global implications. And to add to that, I'm trying to show in this book that in order to understand what was possible and conceivable after the First World War in terms of building a new security architecture, a new architecture of norms in the world, we have to understand a much bigger background. And I'm trying to illuminate what I call the long 20th century, the long 20th century in which the modern international system really came into being. And in my interpretation, this long 20th century started in the middle of the chronological 19th century in the 1860s, and it only has come to an end roughly in our days. So this is what the book is trying to show.
So you don't adhere to the concept of the long 19th century?
I think this is a very interesting and illuminating concept, and I'm engaging with it, but I'm asking in this book, so what is it we have to try to understand if we want to see what kind of transformation took us from the world of the mid-19th century, in which at that point you had still a very kind of variegated world, with a Vienna system in, prevailing in Europe, and very separate sort of spheres of order in the Western Hemisphere, in East Asia, and so on. And so if we try to understand, so what changed the entire world from then onwards, I think we have to go beyond the long 19th century ideas, which always end around 1920, and rather take into view this sort of century that commenced with this globalizing imperialist competition, yeah, that caused so much disarray and violence in the end, and the great wars in my interpretation of the 20th century, but then also the attempts that were made by policymakers, activists, many others, to reconceptualize, you know, what it would take, what kind of international order would have to be built to regain something like global peace, yeah, and global order under the new circumstances. And for this, we need to have a wider focus, which I call the focus of the long 20th century.
Would it be true to say that the late Paul Schroeder was a major influence on how you envisage international politics in the 19th and early 20th century?
Yes, absolutely. Paul has been a long-term sort of mentor and friend ever since I wrote my first book, The Unfinished Peace, after World War I. And the starting point in this book has a lot to do with his idea of what happened in the long 19th century. You might know in his very important work on the transformation of European politics, he, I think, makes a very superb case for understanding the transformation that occurred after the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars and the both European and global significance of the Vienna system. Now, my book, in a way, takes this as the starting point and asks, why did the Vienna order of the 19th century collapse? Why was it no longer possible to maintain something like an international concert, yeah, under the pressures of state development and imperialist competition from the mid-19th century onwards? Yeah? So this is the kind of calamity, yeah? These are the conflicts that in the end, in my interpretation, led to eventual learning processes and attempts to recreate something like a modern Atlantic concert in the 20th century.
Why did the Vienna settlement of 1814-1815 collapse in the mid to late 19th century?
I think one has to look at this both from an inner European and a global perspective. In the inner European perspective, one could certainly argue that the Vienna concert maintained a kind of equilibrium that was hard to reconcile with the ever more forward-moving forces of the age, liberal nation-building forces, at the same time, it could only last as long as those who were maintaining the system were interested in developing it further. And when especially British policymakers were ever more interested in expanding their imperial global system, the British Empire, and were investing ever less in what was happening in continental Europe, this concert corroded ever more. Then, of course, we have the Crimean War, which really made it implode. But I also think, as I try to show in the first part of my new book, that you have the rise of a new kind of set of priorities and understandings of international politics, what I would subsume under the heading Realpolitik, yeah, in the era of Napoleon III and Bismarck on the one hand. And you have these immensely dynamic forces of modern state building in the Industrial Revolution, demographic changes and others, which really altered the entire landscape of international politics, yeah, especially from the 1860s onwards with the unification of Germany, Italy, the reunification of the United States after the Civil War. And so you have a constellation in which there is ever more competition and struggle and ever less coordinated, concerted conflict management. And I think this is something that then finally led to a corrosion of the original Vienna concert instead of its, yeah, globalization. And so you have eventually by 1914 these very, yeah, kind of antagonistic alliance and alignment systems that faced each other when the crisis of 1914 ensued.
So it would be true to say that, unlike some other scholars, you believe that the period of so-called high imperialism was one of increasing instability as per international politics.
Of increasing instability, yeah. So increasing, yes, conflict, and there were many instances. This has been shown by many scholars of managing crises, yeah, of at least preventing an all-out war. But there was structurally ever less being done to address the underlying competition, yeah, and to envisage a kind of international politics that would really led to a more equitable, but also more sustainable international order. And this is, of course, a time, and this is another theme of the book, in which, yeah, you have certain German, Russian, French policies. You have Japan coming in as a new kind of member of the highest tier of this club of imperialist powers. But you also have a United States that is still, yeah, not taking any major international responsibilities, but very much partaking in the informal and partly formal imperialist race, especially, of course, on the so-called Pacific frontier and in China. So I'm trying to show how, yeah, you had certain counterforces, international lawyers, the Socialist International, others who were warning that, yeah, that the kind of mobilization, the kind of competitiveness, the kind of world power pursuit was carrying immense sort of seeds of danger of potential war. But at the core of international politics, you had other kinds of premises that still prevailed, and that, in my view, led to a situation when, you know, 1914, after the first escalation of the July crisis, you have the British Foreign Secretary Sir Edward Grey calling for the European concert to step forward to solve this crisis. He still could utter the words, but the concert no longer existed. And instead, we have the escalation towards war, which then changed everything in the First World War.
Would it be correct to say that you're not entirely comfortable with adhering to the concept of Primat der Innenpolitik in your treatment?
Yeah, it's true. I'm trying in my in the introduction, I'm trying to lay out a new kind of methodological and also theoretical sort of approach to modern international politics. And I find it much more convincing to speak of interdependences and interrelations between domestic politics, international politics, and ever more at this time of world history, transnational politics. Yeah, that is, you have very dynamic inner state developments. You have those that reach across imperial and national boundaries and still have an impact on different domestic scenarios. And you have certain ideas at the level of international diplomacy, and all of these spheres are ever more interconnected. Yeah, so it's no longer possible, if it ever was, to make international politics in the manner of the Congress of Vienna, when you had certain actors being more, not entirely, but more aloof from domestic necessities. My book also tries to show that in this very tumultuous period, we have an overall trend of democratization, of more sort of participation of societies, of different actors, also in international politics, which made eventual diplomatic agreements or peace negotiations far more complex than they had been before, because all of these main actors, if we eventually come to the Paris Peace Conference in particular, they not only had to sort of find ways to reconcile their divergent interests and outlooks, they also had to find kind of agreements that they could legitimize domestically, because they were more or less democratically elected leaders. And this is a structural change in international politics that goes far beyond the primacy of innen or domestic politics, in my interpretation.
Why do you posit that imperial rule of the pre-Great War period was, quote, unsustainable in key respects, unquote?
Mm-hmm. In particular, because I think that it had created a kind of dynamism, a situation where a particular set of states were using their relative and temporary superiority in terms of resources, power projection, and political influence to try to navigate and manage their differences and to allow a kind of expansion at the expense of whoever was not part of this prime club. This became, I mentioned it already, I think especially, of course, blatantly obvious in the so-called scramble for Africa, but you could also see it in the changes in East Asia, where, as I mentioned, only Japan, after the so-called Meiji Restoration, which was more a revolution, was defensively trying to modernize, not to suffer the fate, as they saw it, of the Chinese Empire, which by the late chronological 19th century, in my view, the formative period of the long 20th century, was a subservient state, highly corrupted and at the mercy not just of European sort of spheres of influence and imperial ventures, but also, of course, American capitalist and political influence. And when there was an attempt to found, with Sun Yat-sen and others, a first Chinese republic to try to make China into a sovereign state, the kind of interests and the kind of ideas that still were prevalent at that time made that impossible. So it created a situation in which, in large parts of the world, I think there were kind of hierarchies that were not sustainable for long. At the same time, of course, this pursuit, this competitiveness on the world stage set the mental stage for this mobilization also of military and political and social means that without which you would never have had this very inflammatory situation in 1914. So here too, I think the idea that one could have sort of just kept out of all-out war became ever thinner proposition. And this also made this whole way of doing international politics, in my view, unsustainable, which was then so shockingly shown in 1914.
Why do you state that the United States was, quote, not yet a world power in the decades before 1914, unquote?
In short, as I'm trying to show, modes of conduct and certain traditions, the Monroe Doctrine of the self-understanding of U.S. elites, basically had led to a situation where the United States, after the Civil War, had become a very important industrial, economic, eventually also financial power. But in terms of international politics, it was still a very a power that was picking and choosing. It was trying to have its imperialist cake and eat it without taking any responsibility in the international arena. It was neither part of any alliances or security arrangements. It basically was an aloof power, and there was an ensuing debate within the United States. We can think of figures like Theodore Roosevelt and others who were trying to take the United States more into the direction of a leading power on a par with the British Empire that was supposed to, maybe at some point, as he saw it, head a kind of league of policing powers in the world, but there was no consensus or even a large debate in the United States about what it would really take to take responsibility in international affairs. And the only sphere in which the United States was a leading power was that of international law and arbitration. So, for example, in the making of the Hague Conventions before 1914, but this, again, had not translated into the idea that it should take political responsibility beyond the Western Hemisphere. And of course, in the Western Hemisphere itself, it was acting as a self-appointed imperial hegemon, and losing a lot of legitimacy in the process, and with all the interventions, especially in Central America at this period. So by the time the First World War escalated, it was, as I tried to show, very ill prepared for taking on a major role on the world stage as the new president Woodrow Wilson commanded or was trying to suggest. It is no coincidence that at first he tried to sort of stick to this position that the United States should be a neutral power and stay out of this major conflict, which eventually he could no longer do.
Would it be true to say that you agree with Sir Christopher Clark's revisionist view of the outbreak of the Great War?
Not entirely. As I try to show in my first part, I think the idea that one has to take a very broad view and has to look at the multiplicity of actors, the complexity of the situation, and the the complexity also of decision-making processes, I think this is a very valid point. On the other hand, I do think that the often used sort of metaphor of sleepwalking, of the sleepwalkers, is in part misleading, because I find it does apply to the fact that most of the actors who went into this war could not really imagine, could not conceive of what kind of war this would be, and how destructive and how extremely costly it would be, and how almost unwinnable, on major terms. But there is another aspect to this. I do think that if you look at the German military and political leadership, or the French or the Russian or the British even, you see that they all were very, very much sort of calculating, trying to position themselves and making plans eventually no longer to prevent an escalation of the war, but to be in the position to win it. And this is something that is much more important to understand if we want to see why it wasn't possible to de-escalate in the decisive weeks in the summer of 1914. And this has less to do with sleepwalking than with making calculations based on wrong-headed assumptions. So I don't agree there. Finally, one I think has to see that this is it's such a politicized dispute. But whereas all of these powers bear part of the responsibility for creating the situation, it is especially true that the kind of lack of clear leadership structures in the Wilhelminian Empire and their military leadership's idea that at some point they had to take the initiative for what they thought of as a kind of preventive war, particularly narrowed the choices between war and avoiding war. And so they bore a particular responsibility for this outbreak. But I would agree with Chris Clark insofar as it would be very misleading to sort of continue this blame game debate endlessly and to exonerate the other actors in the July crisis by pointing towards the German Empire.
Why do you say that the Great War caused, quote, tectonic changes in the international order, unquote?
Yeah, one can see this, I think, on several levels. The most sort of tectonic, really kind of structurally changing change that I can see that I think this war caused is that it really made collapse the former kind of basic hierarchy, which was still of world order or disorder, which was still a very Euro-centered kind of world order in which not just the British Empire, but also the other European imperial powers had an inordinate amount of influence and power and on the way in which world politics was pursued. This collapsed when not just the so-called Eastern empires, the Russian Empire, the Austro-Hungarian and the German Empire collapsed as a consequence of the war, but the entire kind of international system that had existed before 1914 really was corroded. Secondly, we have this immense global impact of this war in that it gave a first opportunity and a first incentive for all those that had not been equal members of the old order, namely those who had lived under different forms, not just of colonial rule, but also imperial subjugation, formal or informal, to try to change the basic to turn the table of world politics and to take a stand in trying to create a new kind of world order that was supposed to be truly global and far more egalitarian. Finally, these actors and others, like those in Central and Eastern Europe, who in like Poles or Czechs and Slovaks and many others, were trying now and successfully trying to carve out states of their own out of the wreckage of the former empires. All of those could now point to the advent of two major forces that also had already been present, but rather peripheral before 1914. On the one hand, the socialist Bolshevik left alternative, saying that this war should just be the beginning of a much more sort of radical revolutionizing change in the international order, the building of a new order of Soviet republics on the Marxist-Leninist model. And on the other hand, the fact that the American power that I just described as having still been aloof and rather staying out of world politics in central aspects was now under the leadership of Woodrow Wilson, but also under the influence of many other American political and intellectual figures, stepping forward and suggesting that, quite contrary to what Lenin and what others were saying, this should be the time to build a more American style, new world order, based on self-government, as Wilson would have it, on certain ideas of lawfulness in international relations. And that was now trying to suggest that this kind of new world order could be built around what Wilson, borrowing from British liberals, called a League of Nations. So the overall power structure and the sort of the question of who were the protagonists who really could were in a position to point to the kind of future of world order, all of this had changed so tectonically, dramatically, because of the First World War.
What do you make of Woodrow Wilson as a statesman? Would not American policy during this period have been, for lack of a better expression, more rational if either Roosevelt or Taft had been in the White House when the Great War broke out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting question. I hope my book contains a very comprehensive and it's probably a critical, but I hope balanced appraisal of Woodrow Wilson. I think a particular sort of, I think one thing one has to say at the beginning is that, so Wilson, my book is also a book about learning processes, not just linear learning processes of, sort of finding ways of doing, of finding a better way, a better practice, a better solution to problems, but the very fact that these immense challenges of the First World War and all the ramifications and repercussions it brought posed to political actors. And Woodrow Wilson, in my interpretation, is a particular example of a politician who had come to be president on a largely domestic reform agenda, the new freedom agenda. Yeah? So an idea of building, reforming a progressive state in the United States, and who then found himself in an environment where he had to, without major experience, without having thought a lot about international affairs, other than in very unoriginal terms, for example, as a liberal proponent of the takeover of the Philippines and sort of liberal imperialism before 1914, he all of a sudden had to find a way, to become the head of a global transformation movement. And I think that his inexperience and his often very blatant inability really to look realistically at the challenges ahead made him quite vulnerable to what I would call ideological hyperbole. Yeah? So he was drawing concepts and ideas mainly from the realm of U.S. domestic politics and tried to internationalize them. And in the process, for example, in suggesting that it was possible and feasible to build a new order of self-governed states that would replace the old order of empire, and at the same time to suggest that one could replace all the old kind of, in his view, European style power politics with a new kind of international politics of collective security based on the League of Nations, of course, created, I think, expectations and created sort of or heightened demands for change that he himself was not in a position to deliver. And I think one of the most interesting questions here, and this is a central theme of the fourth part of the book, which deals with a new reappraisal of the Paris Peace Conference, is how far Wilson and his advisors really had to learn that they could not simply decree the terms of this new world order, that they were not in a position of power or did not have the kind of prestige or the kind of bargaining power to basically determine what would happen in post-World War I Europe, East Asia, and so on. Rather, they had to learn how to negotiate, how to pursue very complex negotiations, especially with the most powerful counterparts that they would encounter, the British government, the French government, the Japanese delegation, and others. And in this respect, this is speculative. One could imagine that if you had someone like Theodore Roosevelt, he would have, for example, tried in his own way to build far more of a common kind of front and a sort of with, for example, the British government, or would have been, let's say, more forthright in pursuing certain priorities. But my underlying point in this book is that any American leader at this time faced an immense double challenge, namely to learn on one level to negotiate, to interact and engage with the rest of the world in finding new terms of world order, and on the other hand to persuade, convince American public opinion, but also Congress and the different power structures within Congress, of course, especially the oppositional Republicans, that his kind of future idea of an internationally committed United States as the stalwart sort of hegemon of the new League of Nations would actually be both in America's interest, but also what what Wilson called true Americanism called for at that time. In fact, this was very contested. And as we know, Wilson was particularly inept at building political sort of bridges between the different factions in Congress, and eventually failed in his attempt to try to sort of pressure Congress into accepting the Treaty of Versailles and his vision of the League of Nations with major, major consequences. If Taft or Roosevelt had fared better at that stage, I'm not so much into speculative history.
What do you mean, or perhaps you could elaborate a bit, when you state that the Great War lasted too short a time period to allow for a greater learning processes by the statesmen at the helm of politics at that time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the underlying, as I mentioned, underlying themes of this book is to try to understand what we really mean if we say that we can speak of more fundamental learning processes. And in my interpretation, the catastrophe of the First World War, yeah, so in many ways didn't just shake up empires and sort of structures of territorial possession or any of that. It also shook to the core, yeah, the very assumptions, the underlying ideas of international politics, such as they had been practiced up to 1914. So this, yeah, this idea that if you wanted to be a world power, you had to engage in this game of high imperialism, and you had to mobilize your populations, and you had to, in the end, be prepared to win in a major international war, yeah, if that became necessary. So, as I'm trying to show, many of the actors who would come to the fore, to the helm of their respective states, nations, or movements during the First World War, they were in part trying to draw lessons from, yeah, the catastrophe of the July Crisis and this ever, yeah, sort of more sort of escalating industrial mass slaughter war that ensued afterwards. But they were still, on the other hand, very much in thrall of the kinds of assumptions or ideas of hierarchy, of what international security was based on, that had prevailed before the war. Yeah? They had been socialized. Most of them had been socialized in this era of high imperialism. And in Wilson's case, to start there, I think one can show, as I try to show quite clearly, that whereas he was using a lot of a new, yeah, language of egalitarianism, of equal rights, of those who, yeah, had been just objects of international politics now coming to the table of the League of Nations and so on, he, on the other hand, was a politician with strikingly hierarchical views of, yeah, who was supposed to be at the top of the global hierarchy and who was capable, for example, of governing themselves. And so he was exhibiting a lot of basic assumptions that many liberal and not so liberal imperialists had espoused before 1914. And in Wilson's case, this created an obvious, yeah, massive tension between the rhetoric and the kind of expectations it created on the one hand, and his actual practice of, for example, negotiating major terms of, for example, the mandate system of the League of Nations in a way that was mainly serving the interests of the top-rung powers, of imperial powers, and not so much of those who wanted to escape from the yoke of imperialism. Similarly, I think a very interesting case here is the attempts of French policymakers, Georges Clemenceau, those who were, you know, trying to re-devise French policies after the First World War, to, on the one hand, think of a better way to ensure French security, especially against a possible future German attack. Yeah, on the one hand, and on the other hand, they're kind of being wedded to older concepts of of maintaining a certain military balance of power that basically led them to try to design a League of Nations, also an alliance with Britain and the United States that came into major conflict with British and American ideas of creating not an exclusive kind of new order of the victors, yeah, that would just contain and basically subdue the vanquished of this war, especially the newly founded German Republic of Weimar. And in this way, they too, were on the one hand trying to learn lessons to try to base French security on a different structure than before 1914. Yet they were still practicing, or made political choices that were much more in tune with the old style politics. And this is a general, this is I think one of the general phenomena. In my outlook at the end of the book, I'm trying to suggest that one way of understanding the long 20th century in a new way is to get away from these ideas of the 20th century 30 years war, that have long been rather influential, where you think there's almost an inevitable escalation of a First World War and then a Second World War. I'm more interested in what I call a 50 years learning process, where some of the questions of how to build a more legitimate and more stable European and global order that were already on the horizon in 1918 are only being dealt with more convincingly after the even greater shock of the 1930s, the Great Depression, and then the Second World War. And some of the structures, such as the North Atlantic Alliance or the later idea of having an inclusive European recovery program, these ideas were already around in 1918, but they could only be implemented after deeper lessons had been learned on both sides of the Atlantic, also by American policymakers. And this was not possible yet. In the short interval between the US really engagement in the First World War in 1917 and the Paris Peace Conference in 1919, this was too short a period, too massive a shock to draw more fundamental lessons.
So you do not agree with the late Zara Steiner's more positive view of the Versailles settlement?
I have great respect for Zara's book, The Lights That Failed. I think it's a real milestone. It's a great work. But I generally tend to disagree with the idea that in the end, I think she's absolutely right. And I'm also trying to stress that in my book. In emphasizing how demanding and complex the task of order building and peacemaking was after the Great War. So any account that would say, would easily suggest, oh, they failed here or they didn't do that and they could have done better, I think that's very fallacious and very misleading. On the other hand, I think Zara Steiner's work is the best kind of the kind of work that suggests in the end what was done in 1919 was the best possible compromise, and it could have worked if it only had been executed. And here if you've read the book, you will have seen, I take a fundamentally different view, because I do think that in its original form, the kind of system that came to be known as the System of Versailles, and then we also have the other Parisian kind of treaty systems that were negotiated at that time, it had fundamental shortcomings, fundamental flaws. It was in the end a peace and order settlement that lacked legitimacy in profound ways, that excluded a lot of the kind of players that you had to integrate into a new order if you wanted it to last. And this concerned, of course, the Soviet Union, which was still in the, this is still the time of an ongoing civil war where it was unclear what the outcome would be. But especially, and this is one of the key points of this book, it is a settlement that as yet failed to offer any real form of inclusion and mutually beneficial positioning of the defeated powers, especially the nascent Weimar Republic in Germany. I'm trying to show in my final sort of outlook of this book that a lot of what actually benefited international order was done not in 1919, but in the years after the Paris Peace Conference in the 1920s, when after further crises and the Versailles system showing itself as being rather unsustainable, especially, of course, after Wilson's defeat in the treaty fight, new steps were taken. And by the mid-1920s, you have the beginnings of a reform, quite a fundamental reform of the Versailles system through the London Agreements of 1924, settling reparations to an extent, and especially then through the Locarno Security Pact of 1925, a first real kind of negotiated settlement on security questions in which the political representatives of the Western powers, East European states, and the Weimar Republic, especially Gustav Stresemann, the foreign secretary at the time, came together and both agreed on terms of security, with a lot of American support in the background. So I'm trying to show that rather than focusing too closely on the moment of 1919, what we have to do if we want to understand what really transformed international order in the long 20th century is to look at more long-term processes of ordering, of negotiated settlements, in which, for example, the 1920s and then the late 1940s and 1950s stand out as two very, very formative periods of in which the kind of international order that is still with us today in fundamental ways, but is under threat, was actually being created.
Why then do you disagree with the realist critique of the Versailles settlement?
Yeah, I think I already made that clear, I hope. So I think the most influential realist critique of the settlement of Versailles, in my view, is that, especially British, but even more so US policymakers and governments were not sufficiently willing to support France in basically maintaining a piece of force and a piece of containing by all possible means and isolating the defeated powers to prevent a German resurgence. The idea that became very current again, of course, after the rise of Hitler and the Second World War, that the real problem had been that Germany had either not been sufficiently sort of broken up or put under such restrictions militarily, economically, and in terms of its sovereignty, that it could never have had the capacity to challenge this Versailles system ever again. And as I'm trying to show, I think that a thorough, comprehensive analysis shows that the priorities in 1919 were quite different ones. Namely, that as some very important American and British, also French actors understood at the time, the real challenge was to create a kind of security architecture through the League, but also through American and British assurances to France that would allow a process of safe integration of the defeated into the post-war order. Namely, the idea that strengthening a republican order in Germany with clear commitment to the kinds of rules of arbitration, of international law, of the League of Nations, and a kind of especially Franco-German peace process after the 1919, under the kind of supervision and with the guarantees of the United States and Britain, and the creation thereby of a kind of renewed international concert. This, in my view, rather than kind of realist ideas of containment, would have brought the best assurances of preventing a scenario like that of the 1930s. And here, I think it's quite interesting to see to what extent the aforementioned developments around 1925, the Locarno Security Pact and other advances that were being made at the same time, actually started to build this kind of new Euro-Atlantic peace architecture. As I try to show, it was the overwhelming shock of the Great Depression and the kinds of negative developments it caused, especially in Germany, but also in other states, that unfortunately undermined these first attempts to basically anchor a Western-oriented Weimar Germany to this post-war order. But it didn't mean that all the steps that had been taken to try to do this were false. So in that sense, I think that the usual or the most preeminent realist critique misses the major points.
In your recounting of the period of Locarno diplomacy, you seem to accord more agency or importance to the American administration than, say, in Jacobson's treatment of the same period. What is the basis of your differing interpretation?
So this goes back to my what also is in the introduction of this current book, a more comprehensive understanding of modern international politics. And so I'm trying to show that if one does a comprehensive analysis of what happened in the 1920s, then one sees that this is not just a matter of, for example, government representatives negotiating security treaties in Locarno or in other Swiss resorts, but this has to be seen against the background of a new kind of alignment of international power, influence, and norms and ideas of international politics. And here I mentioned reparations accords, the Reparations Conference of London of 1924, where you had a lot of background American informal diplomacy and also the agency of American bankers, of financial agents, we might say, like Young, who were trying to sort of prod the Europeans to from a position of ultimatums and very confrontational international politics, that had come to a crisis in the so-called Ruhr conflict of 1923, with a real Franco-German standoff, towards more modern ways of making financial and political agreements that all sides could live with. And as I'm trying to show in this book, these are in some parts almost complex bargains that almost pre-note or sort of predate the kinds of agreements that would nowadays be made within the European Union. At that point, of course, under much more dire circumstances and with a much more hostile basic scenario, you have the first agreements that are actually being negotiated with the help of informal diplomatic processes in which the United States is not at all isolationist. It's not enough just to look at the kind of formal commitments. Are the United States part of the League or not? Are they part of security agreements or not? We also have to look at this much wider sphere of international politics. And there's another dimension to that. This is also the time, especially in the 1920s, when a lot of the non-governmental activists and those who wanted the United States to play more of an engaging, a leading role in international affairs were also stepping up their demands. The Council on Foreign Relations was founded, and other pressure groups. You know, we still have we have a lot of activities of these actors that are also trying to build bridges across the Atlantic, including to Berlin and to Weimar Germany. And this is the wider backdrop, this financial, one might even say cultural, this idea that international politics has to be modernized, it has to be sort of taken out of the kind of spheres in which very few unaccountable leaders were making big decisions into a phase in which a lot of the emphasis was on creating, let's say, a new framework in which it became ever more normal for German, for French, for Polish, and for other policymakers to work on commonly acceptable and legitimizable solutions rather than in perpetuating the kind of antagonisms that the First World War had brought. And in all of these processes, both the Republican administrations in Washington of the 1920s and the new kind of networks of transnationally operating American actors had a major influence, far more than I think more traditional historians have recognized.
If your book could be said to have a hero, I suppose it would be Stresemann. At least in your treatment, he's the statesman who seems to have learned the lessons of the post-1914 period the greatest. Yet, when his private papers came out in the mid-1930s, there was great disappointment in the West at the fact that he seemed to be much more cynical about Locarno diplomacy, and in fact seemed to indicate that under certain circumstances he would be willing to forcibly revise the Polish-German frontier. Mm. That view of Stresemann doesn't make an appearance in your book. Why not?
It's an interesting point. I deal much more extensively with the 1920s and also with Stresemann in my first book, The Unfinished Peace. So if you want to have a more in-depth treatment, that's where I would suggest you go. And I wouldn't say he is a real hero here. He's one of the most striking figures. So if heroes are those who try to learn some lessons, then we can start even with Clemenceau, with Wilson, with Lloyd George, with Scheidemann, and those who were trying to learn something on behalf of the Weimar Republic in 1919. And later in the 1920s, of course, one would think of figures like Austen Chamberlain, British Foreign Secretary, who really was one of the main negotiators behind the Locarno Pact, and of course Aristide Briand. Yeah, so Stresemann is one of a whole sort of collective of international leaders, and I'm generally, as I hope you will have seen, I'm not very interested in a kind of blame game history where you have certain heroes on one side and villains on another. I'm trying to look at the bigger picture. In this bigger picture, Stresemann is particularly interesting because he undergoes such a major process of reckoning. Yeah. So during the First World War, he was known as Ludendorff's young man, a vociferous sort of proponent of major German imperial schemes, of a greater German domination of Europe. And I think he's one of the politicians, as also, for example, Jonathan Wright's excellent biography has shown, who really was trying to reassess the underlying premises of his thinking and to come to different conclusions. he was greatly aided in that by his assistant and collaborator von Schubert, who is an even more interesting sort of thinker in terms of a new direction in Weimar German foreign policy. Yet Stresemann, and here we come to the other part of your question, I hope, he was also an actor, of course, who had to scale very sort of problematic force fields. Yeah, so he had to gain legitimacy for what I believe was his genuine commitment towards a new European and Euro-Atlantic concert, towards collective security in Locarno, and towards Franco-German reconciliation. And so he had to find support for this behind the scenes in a German kind of constellation in which you had a lot of political figures, but also members of the public being still very, very disaffected with what they saw as the dictated peace of 1919, still very influenced by German propaganda of the war and the immediate post-war era. And Stresemann, who had worked as a journalist, was especially very, very good in trying to address audiences in ways in which he, in such ways as he thought would allow him to carry on with his not at all cynical, in my view, policies, but very realistic policies of arguing that it was completely illusory to try to prepare the ground for a new German victory in a great war, in a rematch of the First World War. Yeah, but he, for example, had to keep at bay forces like the former crown prince and others, even in his own party, who were much more nationalist or reactionary. And so a lot of the kind of rhetoric he did use behind closed doors, if one looks at it in a wider context, you can see he did use in a Machiavellian, in an instrumental fashion, but they did not reflect his genuine convictions, in my interpretation. Yeah, so in that sense, he's a very representative figure who is trying to really instigate a reorientation in the mentalities of his nation at a time when the German debate was still highly, highly polarized.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, Professor, what would it be?
I think in the end, it is a thought that has a lot to do with the current calamities, the current problems we face in the world. And that is, I hope one realizes when reading this book, how incredibly difficult and with how incredibly massive sacrifices it was attempted to build for the world a more legitimate, a more egalitarian, a more democratic international order that would prevent what up to that point had been chronic escalation of tension, conflict, and eventually massive war. And I hope to instill, to show in this book that this was something that famously Max Weber called the drilling of very, very thick planks. Yeah. So what worked, what created such order, were not easy decisions made at a peace conference or something that could be done in a short time, but rather the lasting commitment to trying to not just develop ideas about collective security, sovereignty, human rights, and minority rights, but also to find frameworks that would effectively protect them, and to not just suggest that this was a task for a few aloof statesmen, but for wider societies. And the book tries to show in the end that this is a task that is never done. You never turn the corner and say, well, we've done all that, now we can concentrate on something else. And I think our current crisis shows, when we look at Russia, we look at the problems over Taiwan and China, that a lot of these harder lessons and the willingness, not just of governments, but also of voters, to stay attuned to these broader challenges and to ask themselves, what kind of international engagement and understanding are required to meet them. Yeah, this is sort of the legacy of the Atlantic, the new Atlantic order. And that's something I hope the book does convey.
On that observation, I would like to thank you very much, Professor, for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Cutillo. You've been listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thank you, Professor, very much.
Thank you for all your very, very interesting questions, Charles. All right. Thank you. It was a pleasure.